It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
SmackDown sucks. It's almost as bad as Raw.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Welcome to episode 732 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, November 28th, 2021. I am the Solo Monster. I hope everybody had a very happy Thanksgiving and had a lot of great food, as I did. It's going to take a few weeks now to work all of it off. But hopefully you enjoyed the holiday. Kind of a quiet week as far as major wrestling news is concerned, but we've rounded up a bunch of stuff here. We do have a lot to get into. We have to talk about, obviously, the situation with Seth Rollins from earlier in the week, which turned into a mainstream news story. GCW, some big news on a historic milestone for them. And some contract news where regards Johnny Gargano, a backstage trainer and producer for NXT, decides to bid farewell to WWE. So all that and a lot more to get into. If you are still interested, the Black Friday sale is still ongoing on prowrestlingtees.com/solomonstersoundsoff. 20% off all shirts in our store. No coupon code is required, but the sale does come to an end on Monday. So tomorrow, November 29th. So if you want a discount on any of the shirts in the store, you got a few hours left to get in on that. I want to say thank you to everybody who has supported the show, be it on YouTube or via PayPal, which you can do so on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out. I got a shout out first and foremost, Ms. Madness, Michelle Mills, who dropped a bomb on me this morning. So Michelle, I do appreciate the support. I hope you are doing well, and I hope that you had a very happy Thanksgiving. Ostentatious Alan Carter coming in hot this week. Alan, I hope you're doing well. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Night Stalker, Naif Al-Safar. Big Bear, Brian Becerra. Beast Mode, Brock Joseph. Killshot, Keith Hart. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. New York Punk, Arnold Modesto. John Raging Mad Riffle. The Pastor of Pain, Damian Yule, and Malevolent Michael Timoney. Those are our top supporters for this week. I thank each and every single one of you guys. And for those of you who are not a channel member on YouTube, just be aware we've got some new stuff that's going to start pushing out to the channel this week. Some fun stuff there. So if you're interested in becoming a YouTube member, you can click the join button on the channel. It'll give you all the information there and you can just go from there. Malakai Black. I mentioned Malakai is going to be part of the next House of Glory event. The House of Glory becomes the House of Black on Saturday, December 11th. And now we know who he is not only going to be stepping into the ring with, we already knew that, but a new name has emerged. And we also know who he is going to be stepping into the ring with. The two top matches are now signed, sealed, and delivered for House of Glory on December 11th, start time 7 Eastern, live on Fight TV. It's going to be Black against Red, the Amazing Red, and Buddy Matthews, the former Buddy Murphy, will be making his Hog debut. He will be challenging Low Key for the Crown Jewel Championship. So that's one hell of a 1-2 punch. For that show, I will be back on the call again. I hope you can be there or join live on Fight. First three rows are sold out. General admission tickets are available at hogwrestling.net. I'll talk more about it once the card fills out a little bit more and we get a little bit closer. It's coming up pretty quick, about 2 weeks away. Very excited. There were interviews with a couple of legends that caught my eye, and I thought they were worth mentioning this week. The Undertaker made an appearance on WWE's The Bump. The Godfather did also, separately. And he was his usual gregarious self and very jovial, loving life. Shane McMahon popped his head in to the studio as a surprise. So they had a little Fun little reunion there with him and the Godfather. I guess Shane dropped by the office that day and heard the Godfather's voice booming through the halls and decided to pop his head in, so that was cool. But Undertaker was on, and he expressed an interest in getting more involved in the coaching and mentoring side of things with WWE. Hat tip to Fightful for the transcription here. He said, I'm trying to find where my niche is and that aspect because I think I'm a natural mentor type. I love being, when I'm in the venues and I'm around the guys and people come and pick my brain, I really enjoy that and talking philosophy. Now, Undertaker spent 30 years in the ring, over 30 years, and he had an incredible longevity for somebody his size, with a gimmick that I think if it were almost anybody else, probably would have died off very quickly. He made it work, and he parlayed that into a Hall of Fame career. So he is certainly someone the younger generation can learn from. I think he could be a great asset to them. Although I'm starting to question his judgment after the next comment that he made. He was asked about Omos, who has been under the learning tree for much of this year with AJ Styles on Raw. Another great person to learn from. Undertaker had this to say about the big guy. The biggest thing for him, and it's funny that you mentioned him because I'll say this. There will never be another Andre, but this guy is as close as we've come. I mean, and that's a big statement, absolutely, but he's special, almost as special. The big thing for him to know and to realize is that he is special and that he is different from everybody else. There's nobody. The average size of the wrestler in general is smaller than it was. So here's this guy who is incredibly athletic. He's incredibly huge. He is a big, big, strong man. It's important for him to make sure that he protects that. Sometimes you guys don't understand what that means. I've had a couple of conversations about what he should do and what he shouldn't do, and if things get too heated, call me. Now, I do understand what he's saying when he talks about protecting him because of his size. He's right. There aren't a lot of guys in today's WWE that look like Omos does, that have the size and the presence that he does because the man is over 7 feet tall, legit. He doesn't want to see him booked like everybody else on the roster. He probably doesn't want to see him selling too much for guys half his size or doing any high-flying moves that a 7-foot guy shouldn't be doing. So that I understand. But to compare him to Andre the Giant and say that he is the closest thing that WWE has seen to Andre, first of all, that sound you heard in the background is the Big Show's heart breaking in two. That's kind of a slap in his face, I think. And not just because they used to call him Andre's son. But outside of his height, what exactly has Omos done to lead one to believe that he is the closest thing that we have seen to Andre the Giant? The answer is nothing. He has done nothing. Giant Gonzalez was taller than both of them, and he could barely walk. Same with the Great Khali. It was painful to watch him walk. Omos is more mobile than either of those two. He has improved a bit since working with AJ as far as some of the big man spots that he does. You know, I look at him in the ring sometimes. He still looks to me, every time I see him in the ring, he still looks like he's a second away from just cracking up laughing. And again, he's still very inexperienced. He's still finding himself. Maybe that's something that will change in time. But watch his facial expressions. Watch his face when he's in the ring. He always looks like he's about to just start laughing hysterically. But to compare him to Andre the Giant, from an athletic standpoint, Omos couldn't hold a candle to what Andre was doing in the 70s, before his body started breaking down on him. Andre was tremendously agile in the ring for a man his size back then. I mean, if your only frame of reference for Andre was the first WrestleMania and beyond, you missed Andre in his prime. I miss prime Andre. But I've gone back since, and I've watched him, and he was incredible. We haven't seen anything even remotely close to that from Omos yet. I mean, it's a great compliment, and Omos went on Twitter and he responded and he was humbled by it. But he's got a ways to go before I think we can start making comparisons to Andre the Giant. That, to me, is just ridiculous. He's still the Jolly Green Giant out there. And I think the biggest thing that hurts somebody like him, again, AJ Styles, Great person for him to work with, great person for him to learn from. But if he had come up in a different time in the wrestling business, in the territory days where he would have had different places to work, or even if they had kept him down in developmental and allowed him to actually develop more, which I thought was the whole point of developmental, instead of putting him on Raw way before he was ready to be there, he would be able to improve his game before we even got to lay eyes on him. Today, he doesn't have that luxury. He's got to kind of learn on the job because Vince McMahon took one look at this guy and said, holy shit, we got to get this guy on TV. We don't have anybody who looks like him. You know, Andre also wouldn't have been as special if he was on Raw every single week. A lot of those guys who got over as major stars in the 70s, the 80s, the early 90s. Not all of them, but a lot of them also would not have been as special. They would not have gotten over as big if they were constantly, you know, on television every week, 3 hours every Monday of Raw or 2 hours of SmackDown, whatever it is. You know, they also would not have felt all that special and they would have been played out. But right now, he's just another in a long line of big guys that have come along, a lot of which have fizzled out. You know, maybe Omos will be different because he has a lot of people in his corner supporting him. Undertaker's talking him up. Kevin Nash had a hand in training him. But he's got a long way to go before he can be compared to Andre the Giant. And last weekend, Jerry the King Lawler appeared on Busted Open Radio. And he was asked about how much wrestling, WWE or otherwise, he watches on a daily basis or on a weekly basis. So Bully Ray asked him. And the answer, not surprisingly, was not much at all. Lawler has been mailing it in for years. If you listen to his commentary or if you watch him on any of the kickoff panels, he just did one at Survivor Series last weekend. The man is 71 years old. He's not sitting down every week watching Monday Night Raw. However many years he's got left, do you really believe that he's going to waste them on Raw? I would advise against it. I'm a lot younger than he is, and I already am wondering what I'm doing wasting my life watching Raw. But at least I have a reason for doing so. Hat tip to Wrestling Inc. for filling in any gaps I may have missed here while I was transcribing this. Because I did go and listen. Because sometimes intonation is important and you go back and you listen to what they're saying. And maybe they were joking when they were, you know, other people think that they were being serious and context could be lost. There was no context lost here. I listened to the whole thing. This is what he said. Sometimes it's sort of hard for me to watch. I just got my schedule to be at Survivor Series, and so it's almost like cramming for an exam back when you were in school. I really have to go back and watch some shows and make some notes and find out what is actually going on. I don't see how the guys in the business, it's so tough to be doing that on a daily basis. Doing the commentary for Raw and SmackDown now, to me, it's almost brutal to have to know and remember. The talent changes so fast in the matches. Everything is so short now. It's not the fault of wrestling. People love to talk about how wrestling has changed. Wrestling hasn't changed. It's the fans. It's society that has changed. We've got a short attention span now. In the wrestling business, you have to realize there's so much more stuff that fans can watch. So you have to keep this show so exciting every minute that people are watching, or else they're going to switch over and start watching TikTok. It has changed in that respect, and sometimes for me, it's hard to follow. So he doesn't actually follow any of this shit. They fly him in, he spits out some generic takes on certain guys, throws out a couple of dated one-liners, collects his paycheck, and he goes home. That's pretty much been Lawler's WWE run for the last 10 years. As far as him claiming the wrestling hasn't changed, the fans have changed, society has changed, society has changed. That's why his announcing run ended last year when he called an Akira Tozawa cannonball a ramen noodle moonsault. He talked about that too. He said he believes that may be one of the reasons why his commentary run came to an end on Raw. He said, I really believe that may be one of the reasons I'm not doing commentary on Raw right now. I didn't call a move a triple indie. I called a move a ramen noodle moonsault. All of a sudden, I was the biggest racist ever for saying ramen noodle moonsault with a Japanese wrestler in the ring. Lawler is fucking old. Right, we know that. Lawler is fucking old, so it should come as no surprise that he is a relic of another era where a lot of stuff like that was said. Bobby Heenan. I love Bobby Heenan. Bobby Heenan did stuff like that too. Bobby would not have lasted 10 seconds on headset today before he would have been filleted on social media and he would have been banished from the company. They would have been taking him out of the intro the way they took out Ric Flair's woo. You know how many Indian jokes he made about Tatanka just in 1992 alone? We're calling Tito Santana's flying forearm a flying jalapeno. So when Lawler says society has changed and how it reacts to things, he's not wrong. But I think laying it all at the feet of the fans and society is such a cop-out. When he says that wrestling hasn't changed, it's the fans that have changed. Some fans do have short attention spans, but that's also because there's so many more hours of WWE on television than there used to be. You know, Raw used to be an hour every week, plus the syndicated shows. Then Raw went to 2 hours. Now Raw is 3 hours every week. Eventually it'll be 4 hours. There's so much more on television. 3 hours every Monday alone, 3 hours of shit, is going to drive people to look elsewhere. Whether it's TikTok, whether it's YouTube, whether it's some other television show, whatever it might be. So spare me the argument that wrestling hasn't changed. The company you work for is the one most responsible for the changes that we have seen in wrestling. Whether it is how overly scripted things have become, the corporate buzzwords they try to jam down our throat every 5 seconds on these shows, the lack of quality storytelling, the inability to properly book babyfaces, which was on full display on SmackDown this week. More on that in a little bit. You know, Jerry Lawler in Memphis knew how to book a great babyface. Vince McMahon lost the plot on that a long time ago. Wrestling and the fans have both changed, and not always for the better. But you can't just lay that at the fans' feet. I know a lot of these WWE people love doing that. They love blaming the fans for everything. It's all their fault. You can't lay that at the fans' feet entirely. He just doesn't want to bite the hand that still feeds him. AEW made it official this week that the live special on TNT, and it will be live on Saturday, January 8th, will be called the Battle of the Belts, which I can only assume will be all championship matches. I think the show, they haven't announced a length for the show. Again, Meltzer had previously reported that it was supposed to be an hour. That could always expand. I feel like 90 minutes would be a good length. That's what the old Saturday Night's Main Event shows were. Some of them, anyway, were 90 minutes long. But anyway, that is official now for January 8th. January 5th is going to be their first live Dynamite on TBS. So that first week in January is going to be a very big week for AEW. And I would have to assume that we're going to get Bryan Danielson challenging Hangman Page for the AEW World title on that Battle of the Belt show. On Dynamite Wednesday, we had one of the best television segments all year on any wrestling show to open up the show. CM Punk and MJF engaged in a 20-minute promo segment. We don't get very many of those, if any of those, usually, on AEW television. So this was kind of a first for them. I had used in my review on Wednesday, I used the Magic Mike analogy. I said Kevin Nash was once in a movie called Magic Mike. And I knew he was in the sequel. I couldn't remember if he was in the original. I knew he was in the sequel. And yes, I know that there was a sequel. But the way I had phrased it, people said, whoa. Because I had made the comment, I said, you know, this was basically like the sequel. We had Magic Mike. Only the Magic Mike was being held by CM Punk and MJF in this case. And then people immediately were like, well, Solomonster, there was already a sequel to Magic Mike. So apparently we have a lot of Magic Mike fans out there. But anyway, I thought this was fantastic. I thought it was an outstanding segment. I thought that the back and forth, I mean, this is what I had hoped to see when Punk came to AEW and I thought, okay, at some point he's going to have to feud with MJF and the promo segments, the promo battles on television are going to be every bit as good, if not better, than the match itself. I didn't know they were going to go to it yet, but that's what they are doing. They're going in that direction, and I thought that it was a pretty even battle. I would call it a draw. I think MJF got a lot of great burns. I think CM Punk got a lot of great burns, especially when he called MJF a less a less, what was it, less famous or less notable version of The Miz. That was something else. Because a lot of people have said, yeah, MJF is sort of like their version of The Miz. And I would be offended by that, frankly, if I were MJF, because at least on the microphone, we've seen Miz shine in some promo segments, like on Talking Smack with, you know, Daniel Bryan all those years ago. But MJF blows him out of the water as far as heel mic work is concerned. But I thought it was a pretty even back and forth between the two. Got me all hyped up to see them in the ring together, but I'm more hyped up to see what they have in store as far as these segments going forward. My only critique, if you could call it that, was I just hope they didn't burn through all of their best material in one night, because I still think it should be some time yet before they actually get in the ring together. I think we very likely get Punk and Wardlow in the ring together before we get Punk and MJF. You know, I would hold off on that at least until the first TBS Dynamite. Ideally, you would hold off on it until the next pay-per-view. That's not going to be until the first week in March. I don't know if they want to wait that long to do the first match. You could do more than one match between those two guys. Do they want to wait until the beginning of March for the first CM Punk MJF match? But they're going to want a big main event, I'm sure, for that first live TBS Dynamite. Let's say they do Danielson and Hangman 3 days later at Battle of the Belts. You need a big main event on January 5th. Punk against MJF would be a big main event. But if you did not see that segment, they posted the entire thing, all 18 minutes plus, on their YouTube channel. Go find it. It is worth your time. I know not everybody watches AEW week to week, but that's going to go down as one of the best segments on TV all year. Jamie Hayter and Thunder Rosa had an excellent match in the TBS title tournament quarterfinal match. Rosa moves on. We're going to get Thunder Rosa against Jade Cargill in the next round, and Chris Statlander against Ruby Soho, final quarterfinal match in this tournament on TV this Wednesday. I'm sticking with Ruby. She's my pick to win the entire thing. I see bigger things in Thunder Rosa's future. Dante Martin signed a contract to join Team Taz. In a bit of a swerve, Leo Rush caught off guard by this. I look at this and say, probably going to get a Leo Rush-Dante Martin match. Winter is coming. Big Dynamite on December 15th. We might get them one-on-one. But I also think it could be the setup for Dante's brother Darius to return with Leo Rush. And maybe they try to sway Dante back to join with them. You know, Darius, I wasn't sure exactly how long ago he had ACL surgery, because he did have ACL surgery earlier this year. He's now 7 months removed, so he's in that time frame where I don't know if he's been cleared or not, but he could be back any day. He could be back any week now. So I would keep an eye out for Darius. Right about now would be a good time for him to come back, and he could work his way into this storyline. Jim Ross, I noticed it when Dynamite went off the air, signed off in a bit of a weird way. The end of the show on Wednesday night, he made comments to the effect of, I'll be seeing you all very soon. And the very next day on Twitter, he announced that due to my skin cancer care totaling 22 radiation treatments starting on Monday, I will hopefully return to the announce desk on the December 29th Dynamite in Jacksonville. They're going to be back in Daly's place for the final Dynamite of the year. Says, Tony Khan supports me on this strategy, which has been a blessing. My thanks for all of your support. So the best to Jim Ross. He is going to be undergoing radiation treatment. Hopefully no chemo or anything needed. Radiation treatment for skin cancer. I mean, it's the smart thing to do. The guy has to take care of himself. You know, he had some more surgery for possible skin cancer lesions on his back. He posted a photo on Twitter of where they cut him open. And, you know, the guy's 70, in the area of 70 years old. He's not a spring chicken anymore. He's had health issues. He needs to take care of himself. He doesn't have to be traveling back and forth. His spot is going to be there when he's ready to come back, and the announce team doesn't need him right now. They'll be just fine without Jim Ross. They've got Excalibur. They could always slide Taz in there. He and Taz work great together. Shivani is there. Shivani does everything. So they'll be fine without him. When he's good and ready, he can come back. And best wishes to JR. On Rampage on Friday, they had a Black Friday deals match. AEW Women's Champion Britt Baker one-on-one against the very first AEW Women's Champion Riho. We haven't seen Riho on any of the major shows in a while. Last we saw her with anything significant, she was eliminated in controversial fashion from the Casino Battle Royal at All Out in September, where she wasn't actually eliminated. She went out under the bottom rope. There was some kind of a botch. She was gone. Apparently she wasn't very happy about that when she got to the back, and now they are weaving it into a storyline. So she got the match with Britt on Friday with the stipulation that if she wins, she earns a future AEW Women's Championship match. And Riho pinned Britt Baker in this non-title match on Friday. She has now earned the right to challenge at some point. Maybe at Winter is Coming, I don't know, for the world title. Normally, I would not agree with that at all. You know, pinning your world champion on TV clean in the middle of the ring. She cradled her for the pin. I'm not generally a fan of this, pinning your champions on TV. But if you're going to do it, you have to at least follow that up by giving that person a championship match. And that is what they are doing with Riho. Now, the other part of this is that this is part of a story. And Excalibur even talked about this on commentary. The one woman, I mean, I guess you could say outside of Thunder Rosa, but one of the women who Britt Baker has simply not been able to figure out her entire run in this company, has never been able to beat in a singles match one-on-one, is Riho. Riho has her number. And so they wanted to continue that story by having her lose again. And now it's going to lead to a championship match where Britt can finally win the big one and get her win, her elusive win over Riho. They need at least one person between now and the point that they hopefully slot Thunder Rosa in there as the number one contender. They've got to kill time. They need at least one challenger between now and then. Riho is as good as any of them, especially if they tell that story that Britt simply can't figure this woman out. And maybe she will lose her championship, even though she won't. So I at least there's a story there. But generally speaking, this, and WWE has been doing this now, these championship contenders matches where to become the number one contender, you have to wrestle the champion and beat the champion on TV. I don't like it. But at least this has a story behind it. Now, this Wednesday on Dynamite, Cody Rhodes takes on Andrade El Idolo in an Atlanta street fight. Atlanta, old stomping grounds for WCW. I'm sure Cody will be as beloved in Atlanta as he was in Chicago when they threw his weight belt back at him on Wednesday. Chris Statlander against Ruby Soho. That will be in the TBS title tournament. Bryan Danielson takes on Allen Angels of the Dark Order as he is trying to pick off various members of the Dark Order in their hometown. Angels is from Atlanta. So He'll get his head caved in by Danielson on Wednesday. And the Gun Club, Billy and his son Colton, take on Sting and his son Darby. And then Friday on Rampage, they have two championship matches scheduled, which is wise, because Rampage, you know, while it is an easy watch at an hour, has become the second string show, where if you miss it, you really don't miss much. And I think we knew that Rampage was going to fall into that pattern. It's not a bad show. You know, most weeks it's actually, you know, pretty good. It's fairly enjoyable, but it's just unimportant. So by adding two title matches, it makes the show feel more important. Sammy Guevara is going to defend his TNT title against Tony Nese. And the Lucha Bros are going to have a rematch with FTR for the AEW Tag Team Championship. This time it will be 2 out of 3 falls. And that should be a pretty damn good match. Some other news and notes. GCW officially sold out its Hammerstein Ballroom debut for January 23rd in New York City. Per the Observer, they sold over 1,800 tickets. The first day tickets went on sale to the public, and they sold out the remaining 200 or so the next day, which was Thanksgiving Day. So those tickets are gone. The secondary market price to get into the building for that show right now is $90. That's higher than any WWE or AEW show that's on sale right now. So it's a hot ticket. It's pretty impressive for an independent promotion with no television to go into a building like that first time out and sell out. And part of it is just, you know, the the allure of it being the first time. Are they going to be able to sell out the Hammerstein every time if they go back there? Probably not every time, but it's still an impressive feat. The show is going to be streaming live on Fight TV. They did that without a single match being announced. This is strictly just they're riding a wave of momentum among their fans. And, you know, a lot of independent wrestling fans. Not one match announced yet, but they built up a lot of goodwill with their audience. The only names announced for the show so far are Eddie Kingston and the Briscoes, Jay and Mark, who have wrestled in that building many times for Ring of Honor. And if he's out of rehab by then, the GCW champion is still Jon Moxley. And that would be another big name to add. We don't know when he'll be back. I think there's a pretty good chance by January. By the end of January, you know, Moxley will be back. So if he is back, that's just another big name to add to the card. But hold on, everybody. Hold on. Random dude on Twitter who hides his face behind a ninja mask replied to WrestleTix. So WrestleTix on Twitter posted the latest ticket update announcing that the show is sold out. And I made the mistake of looking at the replies. And there was a random dude who was wearing some kind of weird mask. I don't know if his face was burned by acid, if his face is all scarred up and all jacked up, who knows. But he had to chime in because he was puzzled by how this show sold out when he had never heard of the event until now. And when other people replied and said that the guy must not follow GCW's social media, otherwise they would have been well aware of this show taking place, he doubled down. He doubled down on dumb and said that they did, and I quote, a damn poor job on the marketing if I haven't seen Jack about it on any other social media app. You hear that, Brett Lauderdale? I hope you're listening. You must have done a really piss poor job on marketing this sold out show because random ninja dude on Twitter knew nothing about it. Who the fuck are you? If stupidity was a clinical diagnosis, this guy would be home from work collecting disability. Amazing. The night before, GCW will be holding an induction ceremony for the inaugural class of GCW's Indie Wrestling Hall of Fame, also in Midtown at the Cutting Room in Murray Hill. I spent many a late night in that neighborhood, usually singing 80 songs at Joshua Tree into the wee hours. I was devastated when I read that the owners closed it down a year ago. I have not been in the city much, so I only found out about it a few months ago. Jerry Lynn will be inducted to the Indie Wrestling Hall of Fame by Sean Waltman. Homicide will be inducted by Chris Dickinson. Ruckus will be inducted by Sanjay Dutt. And Dave Prazak will be inducted by who they haven't announced yet, but Prazak currently does play-by-play. He previously founded the women's promotion Shimmer in 2005, along with Allison Danger. I think for his influence with Shimmer alone, he deserves to be inducted. So many popular names passed through there and were given a platform early in their careers. Daphne wrestled there. Asuka, back in her Kana days. Paige, Bayley, Britt Baker, Ember Moon, you know, Candice LeRae, Shotzi Blackheart, Deonna Purrazzo, Ruby Soho, back in her Heidi Lovelace days. I mean, the list goes on. I can't even name them all. So strictly for his impact and his influence there, I think Prazak is a most worthy inductee. And Mike Johnson had an update on PWInsider.com about WWE's documentary on Vladimir the Superfan. And it's not a good one. If you are an old school fan, you know who Vladimir is. You have seen him before, I guarantee it, even if you have no idea of the guy's name. Who are you talking about? If you were watching WWF going back to the 80s and through the 90s into the 2000s, you have seen this man before. He is unmistakable. And he was everywhere. In the front row, he was everywhere at all the Madison Square Garden shows, and not even just MSG, he went to other shows as well. During this year's WrestleMania, WWE announced that they filmed a documentary about the guy that was scheduled to premiere on Peacock this summer. They spent more than 2 years filming for this. They interviewed countless names. Hulk Hogan, Shawn Michaels, Jimmy Hart, Bruce Prichard, among others. They said it also touched on the effect that the pandemic had on him with no live fans being allowed at the shows for so long. I was really looking forward to seeing the final product. And I've met Vladimir before. I mean, this guy was like a celebrity when I spotted him on Bourbon Street at WrestleMania 30. I was in New Orleans for WrestleMania the year Daniel Bryan won the championship. And I got, you know, I have a whole picture with him on Bourbon Street. I just happened to be walking. And again, unmistakable. I looked and I said, that's Vladimir. I got to go over and shake that guy's hand. And he couldn't be nicer, just really cool and just having fun and laughing and smiling and everything. And the guy is jacked as all shit. So if you've ever met Vladimir, you know he's, you know, a pretty cool, down-to-earth guy. But I was really looking forward to this because I thought, well, this is interesting, not just about his story and finding out who is this guy. Like, I know his name, and I know, you know, he's the guy that always looked buff, and he'd be wearing the tank tops or whatever, he had the glasses on, and he'd be in the front row, but what's his story? Like, what's the deal with this guy? And how did he manage to get, you know, front row tickets for so long at the Garden and just always be kind of like Johnny on the spot and in the camera frame when all these top stars would come down to the ring and some of them would shake his hand and interact with him? Who is that guy? It's like, I wonder the same thing about some of the front row fans now, the guy in the green shirt guy, who's like there with his mother. I mean, who is this guy? Brock Lesnar shirt guy. Well, I don't really, you know, care as much about that, but there are certain people, there are certain fans, you see them all the time and you wonder, how do they always get the seat in the same place all the time? Who could afford that? Who has time for that? So there could be some interesting fan documentaries. I think you want to be careful. You don't want to necessarily start glorifying all the fans because then they'll just think, you know, they'll think they're part of the show. But I think there are some fans who have interesting stories and people would like to know who they are because they've been seeing them on TV for so many years. So I've been looking forward to seeing the final product. And, you know, Mike Johnson, who is best friends with Vladimir, has also been talking about it a lot over the course of the year. And he saw the final product because it did run as part of a film festival. I think it was like an LA film festival back in September. But Johnson had seen the finished final product of the movie and thought it was fantastic. Summer came and went when it was supposed to drop on Peacock. Nothing happened. And then we started hearing about other documentaries that were scheduled to air that were pulled. Like the WWE Untold on the Nexus. And the Icons episode. They had a whole series of Icons documentaries on Yokozuna and Beth Phoenix and the British Bulldog. And there was supposed to be an Icons episode on Lex Luger. And that also got pulled and never saw the light of day. The Luger one even had an air date. And like, days before, got pulled at the last minute. Because I think they were planning on timing it around July 4th, the whole Intrepid thing when he slammed Yokozuna on the Intrepid, and they pulled it. You know, it's bad enough to film stuff and then not release it. And I had some people say, well, TV, you know, TV networks and movie studios do that sort of thing all the time, as if that's some kind of explanation that makes it better. I didn't ask you to explain to me that it happens elsewhere. I'm saying that it is a shitty situation. It's no less shitty that other companies or other, you know, film studios do that sort of thing all the time. I don't give a shit. I'm talking about this. I don't care what they do. And to me, what makes this different is the fact that in a lot of these cases, like with the Luger thing, and certain other things as well, they even advertised John Cena on the Broken Skull Sessions. And then that magically didn't happen and turned into Seth Rollins instead. But I was led to believe that it was already filmed. Not that Cena was scheduled to do it and had to pull out. So there have been countless examples of them pulling this, but when you give a specific air date to something, when you are actively advertising and promoting it to your audience on TV and on social media, and then you just don't deliver, there is no excuse for that. There is no valid excuse for that. It has nothing to do with budget cuts. This stuff is already filmed. It's done. It's post-produced. It's in the can, ready to run. Johnson's latest update is that there has been no communication between Vladimir and WWE in months, and there are no plans to release the documentary anytime soon, if ever. If the documentary was a wrestler, I bet they wouldn't hesitate to release it. They've released 80 people this year so far, yet they won't release one documentary. There was talk that maybe they were holding back because they were trying to license them to a third party to air them like A&E, or maybe another streaming service, but that hasn't happened. And it's ridiculous when they have their own streaming partner, and this type of content is one of the draws of their own network, outside of the pay-per-views. I don't know what he means by this, but Johnson also said that having seen the documentary himself, if it does not air before the end of the year, some of the ending will be outdated by that point. He says Vladimir has had some health issues of late, so it's really unfortunate that they're holding the film hostage. I don't know what they're waiting for, but between this and the other stuff I mentioned, and again, even the broken skull thing with Cena that was advertised and got pulled, it's embarrassing that they keep making these announcements and failing to deliver. Failing to deliver what is some of the best content they have to offer, better than what they air on television every week. So either keep your mouth shut and don't announce anything until you're actually ready to air it, or even better, get off your asses and air it already. Enough of this shit. Raw on Monday night was back at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn for the second straight night. It was the smallest crowd WWE has ever done at the Barclays Center since the building opened in 2012. They set it up for about 5,500. They basically hit that number, but if they thought they could sell more tickets, then they would have opened it up to a lot more. They could have had north of 10,000. They didn't have anywhere close to that. The big story coming out of the show wasn't anything that happened storyline-wise or match-wise. It was Seth Rollins being tackled to the ground by a mentally disturbed fan who jumped the barricade and managed to get to him on his way up the aisle, which should never have even happened. I mean, this guy never should have gotten close to Rollins from where he was sitting. That's on the Barclays Center and its security team. This is the second time that somebody has broken free from that part of the arena and gotten to one of the wrestlers. 2 years ago, it was Bret Hart who was in the ring. The guy made it all the way into the ring and tackled him. He tackled Bret down to the ground, took Natty down with him. This guy caught Rollins with a pretty good tackle, but Rollins got him in a front face lock until the referee realized what was going on and came over to get him off. Rollins did not lay a hand on him otherwise, which you can't do today because the guy's liable to sue Seth for assault and get a nice settlement out of it. In another era, he would not have been so lucky. If you are dumb enough to jump the barricade, you become a threat. And at that point, you do what needs to be done to neutralize the threat. That is what I believe. These people need to be taught a lesson. You don't get to be part of the show unless you are being paid to be part of the show. You are paying for a ticket to sit down and watch the show, not to be part of it. I'm not going to give this guy's name because he doesn't deserve the attention, but he's 24 years old. He was escorted out of the building. He was taken into custody by the NYPD. And if you saw the fan video, he wasn't even cuffed and detained in the back or anything. They marched him up the stairs very casually through the crowd, up to the concourse, where he was eventually taken into custody. Now, that may be their policy there, I don't know. But why is this guy being casually marched up the stairs through the fans with his hands free after he just attempted to assault one of the wrestlers? What the hell is going on here? He's been charged with attempted assault and attempted violation of arts and cultural affairs by disrupting a live sporting event. What a weird charge. He was issued a desk appearance ticket to appear in court at a later date, and he was released. He should also be banned for life from any events at the Barclays Center and any WWE events for the rest of his life, and I hope that's what happens. This guy spoke to the New York Daily News, and as bad as that all is, it gets even worse. He spoke to the Daily News. And we have more information on why he did what he did. He was trying to assist Finn Balor, or as they spell it in the article, Finn Balor, who Rollins had just left laying in the previous segment. And he was trying to get revenge for what looks like a catfishing scam that he fell victim to 2 years ago involving a fake Seth Rollins account online. Now, I know that's hard to believe. I mean, I'm sure this guy seems like a very intelligent person, probably has an IQ in the genius range. So how could he fall for such a catfishing scam? What a surprise! He said, I apologize to WWE for my actions. I had a legitimate beef, but as a grown man, I could have settled it a different way. If I saw him today, I wouldn't attack him. I have moved on. He said he first met Rollins at a meet and greet a few years ago, where he asked Rollins for help to launch his own wrestling career. After that, he started communicating on WhatsApp and other messenger services with someone that he remains convinced was Seth Rollins, but very clearly was not. He said he was asking to send me gift cards in exchange for money, mostly $500 or more, to see if I was loyal. He asked me to be a wrestling blogger for him. I wanted to work my way up. After buying about $3,000 in cards, the check that quote-unquote Rollins sent back to him, bounced. And he said that he communicated with Seth through accounts under his WWE name and under his real name, Colby Lopez, and he was blocked on social media by Rollins' wife, Becky Lynch. I can't imagine why. I mean, this is the same guy who messaged that fake Rollins account last year, so upset about the way Rollins was treating Dominic Mysterio on TV, that he told him, it's payback time for you, say your last prayers. By the way, how's your wife with her pregnancy? He told the Daily News, my plan was to help Finn Balor. I'm a fan. I like his aura, his attitude. I like everything about his charisma. I like everything about him. I jumped from where I was sitting and I ran and speared Seth Rollins. I busted his lip open and he caught me in a headlock. I broke the headlock and was trying to get him. Then the referees and security guards broke us apart. Rollins, by the way, he already looked like he had a bloody lip before this guy tackled him, so I don't think this guy did shit. He also posted a video online claiming that he did it for the Bloodline and the Tribal Chief. He did it for Rikishi. Jesus Christ. You know, Seth is lucky this clown didn't have a weapon on him. If security at the Barclays Center can't do their jobs properly, this is the second time now, then I think it's time for WWE to beef up their own security when they come back to Brooklyn. I just got done talking about these lunatics last week, on both sides, WWE and AEW. 24 hours later, we saw it on full display. Speaking of clowns, Chavo Guerrero Jr. thought it would be wise to tweet this after the incident on Monday. Remember when the wrestlers were tougher than the fans? Ah, the good old days. He decided it would be smart to mock Seth Rollins for being attacked. And then later on, after rightfully getting a ton of shit for what he said, he followed up with it. He backpedaled. And he followed up with this. He said, that got out of hand quickly. Instead of deleting, I will own it and say no disrespect to Seth Rollins. I have had many agree and many disagree. Only comes from the love of this business that has feed my family for 85 years. The fact is, Seth should have never been put in that position in the first place. That is what you call a backtrack. Even though I would have loved to have seen Seth give this guy a curb stomp, fact is, Rollins did nothing wrong. So, if he meant no disrespect, I'm not really sure what Chavo was going for with that tweet. You know, pine for the old days if you want, that's fine, but don't insult Seth Rollins for handling the situation like a professional. That's just dumb. And so is Chavo Guerrero, your winner for said tweet this week. At Survivor Series, Vince McMahon showed up with a giant golden egg as part of a cross-promotion with Netflix for The Rock's new movie. Just like they did with the zombies that one time for Batista's new movie. Maybe we can get Netflix to cross-promote with WWE in a few months when the new season of Stranger Things drops, and Vince McMahon can go get lost somewhere in the Upside Down. Instead, we got Vince McMahon and his egg, and a show-long storyline where somebody stole his egg, and he ordered Adam Pearce and Sonya Deville to bring the culprit to justice. They continued this storyline into Raw the following night. Now, I don't know about you. I like my eggs scrambled. And sadly, the only thing scrambled here are these people's brains. He promised that the person who finds the egg or brings the egg thief to justice would be gifted a WWE Championship match against Big E at the end of the show. Some promotions have tournaments to find championship challengers. Some have battle royals. WWE has Easter egg hunts to determine their championship challengers. So it turned into the 24/7 title at that point. We had the 24/7 egg on Monday. All the geeks in the back frantically searching for the egg, tearing up the backstage area. And this was the worst part of this egg nonsense, because of all the geeks that they showed running around, and they have a lot of them on that roster, Rhea Ripley was among them. Now, why Rhea Ripley was even bothering to look for the egg, I have no idea, because the person was promised a title match with Big E. But there she was. There was Rhea Ripley looking for an egg like it was 60 seconds away from detonating and blowing up the entire building. Imagine me jumping in my DeLorean and going all the way back to the year 2019. You're sitting at home. You're watching NXT from Full Sail. Rhea Ripley is fighting for the NXT Women's Championship. And you ask me, Solomonster, what does the future hold for Rhea Ripley? She's one of the brightest shining stars here in NXT. In the entire company. What is the future of this woman? And I respond by telling you that 2 years later, she'll be on Raw chasing after a golden egg. You would kick me out of your house and take a restraining order out on me to make sure that I couldn't come within 50 feet of you. And I wouldn't blame you one bit. But then, came the payoff to this story. They found the culprit. It was Austin Theory, who said that he just wanted to take a selfie with the egg. So he took it. But then he got spooked, and so he didn't know what to do, and he took the egg with him back to the hotel. He didn't want anybody to see him with it. So he returned the egg, and Vince McMahon was so impressed by his courageous decision to do the right thing and bring back the egg, he decided to drop the charges and awarded him a WWE title match against Big E, which appalled Sami Zayn, who was the one who brought Theory to him in the first place. Sami said he knew who took the egg, and yet McMahon gave Theory the title match and not Sami. Of course, Sami is on SmackDown, but since when the fuck does that mean anything? They had all the SmackDown people on Raw because they had to search for the damn egg. Vince said, shut up, nobody likes a snitch. That was the only funny part of this entire thing. But brand split be damned. Because when there's a golden egg that is missing, all the rules and everything else, that goes right out the window. We need all hands on deck for the great egg hunt. So after all that, that was the payoff. Austin Theory wanted to take a selfie with the egg. Then he brings it back and is gifted a title match, which he proceeds to lose. Here's how the story should have played out. We talk about WWE and their boring creative all the time. Here's how the story should have played out. The $100 million egg is stolen. We get a whodunit. And we come to find out that Austin Theory swiped the egg for Triple H. Theory's a mole for NXT, and he did Papa H a solid. He gave him the egg, and now Triple H is holding the egg hostage until Vince McMahon agrees to give him the old NXT back. And they agree to a War Games match with the fate of NXT hanging in the balance. Instead of War Games, they call it Egg Games. McMahon gets to choose five of his best from Raw and SmackDown to take on five from NXT. NXT wins, Triple H gets Poppy back, he gets his skulls back, and Vince McMahon goes back to the Wax Museum where he belongs. You ever want some real creative writing, you know where to find me. Randy Orton and Matt Riddle, they continue to be one of the few truly popular acts on this show. Riddle beat Dolph Ziggler while dressed like Randy Orton. He's trying to be more like Randy. He even won the match with an RKO. And after the match, Orton gave Bobby Roode Riddle's bro Derek. Riddle looked real good in the match itself. You know, you peel back all the silliness and you find that Riddle is a damn good wrestler. It's why I was so high on the guy. See what I did there? But I was very high on him. When you go back and listen to my old NXT reviews when he first came there, he can really go in the ring. But some people don't realize it because when they see him, they see the scooter and the corny jokes and him being silly, and they don't realize that underneath all that, this guy is a pretty damn good fucking wrestler. I liked the Becky Lynch promo. She was healing on the crowd for their reaction to the women's elimination match at Survivor Series. Still ridiculous that they have this woman booked as a heel when nobody wants to boo her. But if she wanted to turn the crowd against her, she had a great material to work with, even though it completely neglected the fact that WWE gave the fans no real reason to care about these women fighting in the first place. She said it's time to move on from Charlotte Flair, who she beat at Survivor Series, to somebody new, because the fans love new and fresh, don't you? And she mockingly said, you guys love having fresh faces, so who do you want to see me fight next, huh? Rhea Ripley? Maybe Bianca Belair? How about the new number one contender, Liv Morgan? And people cheered, and she pointed out that she used to care about the fans' opinions, but not anymore. Because last night, 10 women beat the crap out of each other while you people chanted your silly little chants and you did your silly little wave. I love how she took that real reaction and threw it right back in their faces. And then she talked about Liv Morgan and that nobody is taking the title from her. I think it would have benefited Liv Morgan a lot to have her as one of these survivors on the Raw side at Survivor Series. I mean, given that she's next in line to challenge for the championship, but that obviously was not a priority for them. It would not have hurt Bianca Belair at all. She still could have won, but she won the Royal Rumble this year. She headlined WrestleMania and won the women's championship from Sasha Banks. She didn't need to be on the Survivor Series team as the sole survivor. It would not have hurt her at all for it to be her and Liv Morgan as the last one standing. But they wanted to do the story of her coming back from a 4-1 handicap, which only made Team SmackDown look like a bunch of losers. This is one of the many issues with the WWE way of booking. They focus on one person instead of looking at the bigger picture and realizing that they can make several people. Wouldn't it be better to make two people instead of one? And if that one person goes down to an injury, what do you do then? You want to have more than one person who's over, who you can lean on in that division, but they have a very myopic way of looking at things. It's all about the one person that they want to push at any given moment. And I just don't think that's a very smart strategy at all. They advertised a match between Seth Rollins and Finn Balor that never happened. Rollins came out for a promo, Balor attacked, but then Rollins got the upper hand, hit him with the ring steps and two curb stomps. I thought they made Balor look pretty weak here, but I mean, that's been the story of his post-NXT run so far. I mean, especially the way they killed off the Demon at Extreme Rules with that finish in the Roman Reigns match. I'm still appalled by how comically awful that finish was. On the subject of bad finishes, AJ Styles and Andre Omos upset over the Street Profits stealing their pizza the night before at Survivor Series, beat the Street Profits by disqualification when they sprayed Omos with a fire extinguisher. Rather than try to win the match, I guess they figure, well, we'll just get ourselves disqualified because that would be the funny thing to do, I guess. They did do one good thing with Rhea Ripley on this show, all the egg bullshit aside. They took the women's tag team titles off of her and Nikki Ash and put them on Carmella and Queen Zelina. They gave Zelina a crown and now they gave her a paperweight. A belt. They gave her a belt. You know, they may not be worth much, but she's actually winning matches now. I like that she has adopted the Code Red as her finish and is winning matches with it. The Amazing Red is her cousin. It's a nice tribute to him whenever she uses it. But Rhea Ripley needs out of this tag team with Nikki. It's been a giant albatross around her neck, just dragging her down. Chasing after the egg was just the latest indignity. Getting those titles off of them hopefully frees her up to go after Becky Lynch. And her title after Becky beats Liv. Cedric Alexander won the 24/7 title from Reggie, only to then immediately be pinned by Dana Brooke. And when the Brigade of Losers ran down to the ring to challenge for it, when they saw that a woman had won the championship, they acted like they couldn't put their hands on her. So that's the new gimmick now. It's that because Dana is a woman, they have to find a way to somehow get the title off of her. This was pathetic. To see Cedric Alexander have to be party to this was pathetic. Everything about this 24/7 stuff is pathetic. And by extension, so is everybody who was involved with it. Bobby Lashley won a handicap match over Rey and Dominic Mysterio. I like that they are at least continuing to portray Lashley as a monster on TV. They're keeping him strong. Rey and Dom, they can lose because it's being done to further the story between them, which I'm sure is leading to a breakup and father against son feud. And Austin Theory lost to Big E in the main event. Theory did not look out of place out there. He looked pretty good. I do question the need to beat him when he's been on a roll lately on TV. I would be building him up to challenge Damian Priest for the United States Championship at WrestleMania. Kevin Owens and Seth Rollins, they were out there as well, having issues with one another. Big E gave Rollins a big ending to close out the show. As I predicted a few weeks ago, this is all leading to a triple threat match, I think. They just need to find a way to explain how Owens gets a championship match when Rollins is the one with the contract. That may come tomorrow night, because Big E has a match, one-on-one, with Kevin Owens. They're at the new UBS Arena in Long Island for the first time at Belmont Park. Rollins will wrestle Finn Balor, for real this time, maybe, possibly. And Edge is being advertised for his latest return to TV. I would like to see a program with Edge and Owens. Especially if Owens is leaving, I'd love to see it at the Royal Rumble. But if he stays, I think that could be a WrestleMania match. SmackDown on Friday was built around two things, both tied to Roman Reigns. A Black Friday Invitational Battle Royal to determine a number one contender for the Universal title. Their second battle royal in less than a week, including the Pizza Hut one at Survivor Series. And the announcement that Brock Lesnar's suspension has been mysteriously lifted, which came as news to Adam Pearce, who was assaulted by Lesnar the last time we saw him, hence why he was suspended indefinitely. Outside of the Reigns stuff, this was a bad show. There just is not a whole lot of interesting stuff going on. I mean, it's just SmackDown. SmackDown was the A show. It is still the A show when you compare it to Raw, but that's not really meant as a compliment the way it might have been meant as a compliment, you know, 3 months ago. SmackDown has really fallen off. Drew McIntyre and Jeff Hardy won a tag team match over Happy Corbin and Madcap Doink, who just laughs at everything. I'll bet he laughed when he read the creative plans for that Charlotte Flair-Tony Storm segment. I thought it was cool that they let Hardy get the win in his home state, although that fuzzy feeling wouldn't last into the main event when Jeff came back out for the Battle Royal. Ridge Holland had his first match on SmackDown, and he lost to Cesaro. It was short. It was dominant in Holland's favor. He manhandled Cesaro, and then Cesaro used the fancy cradle to surprise him for the win. I noticed they recycled Cesaro's old gimmick for Ridge, where he used to play rugby, but he was kicked out of the league for being too reckless. It's exactly how they introduced Cesaro when he first came into the company. Holland did really used to play professional rugby, at least. Not only did Holland lose his first match, he got eliminated by Cesaro in the Battle Royal later in the show, so he lost twice in the same night. The Charlotte Flair segment on this show was absolutely maddening, and a great example of why Charlotte gets so much shit from people, whether it's her fault or not. When she's booked in segments like this that play out in this way, this is one of the many reasons that she gets shit from a lot of people on social media. And Tony Storm came out to interrupt after Charlotte was being interviewed by Michael Cole first about her loss to Becky Lynch at Survivor Series. Here comes Toni Storm. And I thought, that's good. Consistency. They didn't forget about her this time. By the end of this, I wish they had forgotten about her. She says she still wants a match with Charlotte for the SmackDown Women's Championship. Charlotte admitted she barely even knew that Toni existed. She said there are levels to this, what we do, and I am simply on another level from you and everybody else. Charlotte went for a cheap shot. Toni sent her through the ropes out to the floor. So on the floor, they had a table set up for the previous match, which involved Rick Boogs. And they were doing some stuff with him and Nakamura and Angel Garza and Humberto Carrillo. But there was a table that was untouched that was still sitting outside that had Thanksgiving leftovers. They had a giant turkey. They had pies. They had all kinds of stuff on this table laid out there. Charlotte's on the floor standing there and she's motioning to Toni Storm, come on out here. Come on after me. So Toni Storm goes and heads outside to go after her. And Charlotte pies her right in the face. Literally pie faces her. So now Toni has white frosting all over her. It's on her jacket. It's on her face. It's in her hair. And she just stands there. Charlotte, who went to go leave, walks back over to Toni Storm while motioning for Toni again to come at her. But instead of attacking her, Toni just slowly walks forward towards her so that Charlotte can grab a second pie and smash it right in her face. She hit this woman with not one but two pies to the face. And all Toni Storm could do was stand there and do absolutely nothing. They played Charlotte's music and she left. That was it. Toni Storm looked like she was about to start crying. She looked like the little kid on the playground who got bullied and was about to just start bawling her eyes out. This company has absolutely no clue how to book baby faces. I've never seen anything like it before. They are completely, utterly clueless. Now, maybe they didn't want to give away her comeback on the same show. Maybe, you know, she's going to hatch her own plan for revenge next week. It is an episodic show. Maybe they don't want to give it all away in one week. That still does not explain why she was booked to stand there, take two pies to the face, without even so much as lifting a hand to try to strike back. Or reaching for something else on the table and trying to throw it in her face. She just stood there like a moron. She stood there like such a loser. Any other week, this would have been the stupidest thing I saw. But it happened in the same week that Vince McMahon walked on my television screen with a golden egg. So it was only the second stupidest thing I saw all week. And then on Talking Smack, they interviewed Toni in the back after she wiped all the pie shit off her face, and this is what she had to say about what happened. She said, "Needless to say, I am in Charlotte's head now." Are you kidding me? Needless to say, I am in Charlotte's head now. She didn't have to do this. She could have just walked away. But no, she stayed and she embarrassed me. But you know what? Here's some Toni Storm trivia for you. I actually don't get embarrassed. Well, maybe you should. She says, "I don't get embarrassed, but do you know what's going to be embarrassing? It's her when I take her SmackDown Women's Championship." So the takeaway from all of this is that by standing there and taking two pies to the face, Toni Storm is now in Charlotte Flair's head. That's like the gunshot victim taking two bullets, one to each cheek, and laying on the ground and going, "I'm in their head now." Yeah, so are the bullets that are in yours, you fucking moron. I'm in Charlotte's head now. That's her explanation for this. Oh, the creative writers. Hard at work. You know, we talk about Vince McMahon and Bruce Pritchard and the powers that be in this company and how awful their creative decisions are, generally speaking. And it's not the writer's fault because the writers are probably pitching all of these great ideas, but they're just getting rejected. They just never see the light of day. And I'm sure that's true in certain situations. I think it is time to start calling out the creative team for their dumb shit as well. They don't get a pass. I don't believe that every good idea they pitch is simply rejected and we only see the bad ones. There's a lot of bad ones coming out of that creative team. I don't know how big the team is these days on each show, if it's 10, 15, 20, 25 people, who the fuck knows. However many people there are, this shit sucks. And they deserve as much scorn as Vince and Bruce and everybody else who's in a position of power in that company for putting this kind of shit out there and scripting this kind of garbage. They deserve to be called out every bit as much. You know, I got upset about them debuting Toni Storm in July and then not putting her on television for months. I was wondering, where is she? Where did she go? And then I see them do this and I wish that she would have stayed forgotten. They aired a Xia Li comic book vignette. This is the second one that they've aired on TV now. And these are very well done. And she spoke about a bully who tormented her brother for weeks. And she knocked out the bully. They cut to a live shot of her. And she said that I am the protector of all who are wrong. I don't know. I feel pretty wronged after what I just saw in that previous segment. You protect me? Can Xia Li be my protector from bad television? Probably not. But she is the protector of all who are wronged. And the graphic said, coming soon. She's been coming soon for a while. This woman has been coming for weeks. But Xia Li is on her way to SmackDown. Xia Li is on her way somewhere. It could be the cut list before long. I'm supposed to be excited that Xia Li is coming to SmackDown? I'd like to be. Can't say that I am getting behind her with the same level of enthusiasm given the track record of some of the other people who have been coming soon to this show. Once they arrive, it's usually all downhill from there. Sasha Banks was sticking up for Naomi on this show. She confronted Sonya Deville in the back and wanted to know what her problem is with Naomi. She was putting Naomi over as a former women's champion, and she was sticking up for her former Team Bad stablemate. This led to a tag team match with Sasha and Naomi against Natalya and Shayna Baszler, where Naomi ended up getting the win, and Sonya was at ringside on commentary, and she no-sold it when it was over, and she applauded like she was like, okay, great, you won, congratulations, and Naomi went over to confront her and say, see, I won. And again, Sonya was applauding and just totally no-selling it. Black Friday Battle Royal had Sami Zayn, Cesaro, Ridge Holland, Sheamus, the Viking Raiders, Ricochet, Drew Gulak, Mansoor, Mace, Los Lotharios, Jinder Mahal, Shanky, Jeff Hardy, Rick Boogs, Happy Corbin, and Madcap Moss-covered three-handled Family Gradunza. Right when the match was about to begin, Drew McIntyre, who was left off the list of participants in this Battle Royal, made his entrance anyway. And he came down to the ring with his giant sword and chased everybody out of the ring. He was swinging the sword around. Adam Pearce had to come out. And they went to another commercial break, came back, and I guess he had convinced Drew to go to the back. Battle Royal came down to Jeff Hardy, Ricochet, Sheamus, Corbin, and Zayn, who went out under the bottom rope earlier and was not eliminated. Ricochet got dumped out, Corbin eliminated Sheamus, and Hardy eliminated Corbin, seemingly to win, even though most people knew Sammy was still in. WWE loves overdoing this finish, where the heel sneaks back in and wins the match, which is what happened here with Sami Zayn. Just when it looked like the right man won, Jeff Hardy got dumped out to the floor. And after the match, Caleb Braxton got into the ring to congratulate Sami Zayn on his win. All of a sudden, she was getting breaking news in her earpiece. The suspension has been lifted. Brock Lesnar will appear on SmackDown this Friday night. And Sami and Adam Pearce were shocked by this news. They cut to the bloodline of Roman Reigns in the back, and they looked upset as the show went off the air. So Sami Zayn, temporarily, has a title match in his back pocket that I am almost certain he will lose. Brock Lesnar, we now know, is coming back to TV on Friday. That's earlier than I expected him to be back. I mean, we had heard that he was going to be in LA. I think SmackDown is in LA, not this week, but next. But, you know, before that, I would have expected him back in January, not in December. December usually is just a very boring nothing month in WWE where they're just kind of biding their time until the Royal Rumble. And there are no pay-per-views in December. Outside of the NXT War Games show next Sunday, there is not a single wrestling pay-per-view for the rest of the year. But Brock is coming back on Friday. Sammy has his shot for now. McIntyre was screwed out of a spot in the Battle Royal by management, so they spared him, I guess, having to take a loss because he also will soon be challenging for the Universal title. It's still possible they could keep the Xavier Woods story alive and get to him challenging Roman for the championship. I kind of feel like that program has come and gone. I think it ended the minute that Roman Reigns beat Big E at Survivor Series, since that was the only reason they even did anything with him and Xavier Woods to begin with, was just to tie it into the Survivor Series match. And then Jeff Hardy is just sort of lingering. I think he is the perfect person to be plugged into a title match with Roman Reigns sometime between now and WrestleMania. You know, they have three pay-per-views between now and WrestleMania. Day one on New Year's Day, the Royal Rumble, which is later on in January, and the Elimination Chamber. So they need to start lining up challengers. The Hardy program is a natural. I was pitching that one before they even did the draft, before anybody else even spoke the name of Jeff Hardy challenging Roman Reigns. You heard it on this podcast because it was the natural way to go. And I still hope they get there. On Tuesday, Scott Garland, a.k.a. Scotty Too Hotty, who has been working for years as a producer and a coach for NXT, announced on his social media, "Today I have asked for my release from World Wrestling Entertainment. 30 years ago, I stepped into a WWE ring for the very first time. I have lived my dream 100 times over. Some of my most special memories will always be from the last 5 years working with NXT. The black and gold brand was something special, and I am proud to have been a small part of that. I always promised myself that I would never be part of something solely for the paycheck, and that was where I was at. I told myself that I would walk away if it ever got to that point. So that is what I have chosen to do. Coaching and producing the stars of NXT will always be a highlight of my life. I love you all more than you will ever know." That is a significant statement for him to make. And I don't know if they've granted his release or not. I see no reason for them not to. But it's not like they haven't fucked with people before. That is a hell of a statement to make. If you read between the lines, between the reference to the black and gold brand, given that the black and gold brand no longer exists, and him using the words "was something special," it's pretty clear what Scotty Too Hotty thinks about the changes that have been made to NXT. And him saying that he was only doing it for a paycheck at this point, that's a major move for somebody like him to make, because if you work for that company in almost any capacity other than a talent, you're getting health benefits, among other benefits that, you know, employees probably would receive. And for him to give all of that up and say, "You know what, I don't have a passion for this anymore. I don't want to be here anymore. I used to love this job and now it's just a paycheck." Reading that was like, wow. You know, how many other people who work there feel the same way that he does? How many other people who work there who feel the same way he does would even have the balls to say, "Peace out. I want out"? He managed to deliver a damning statement in the most diplomatic way possible. And I guess he felt the need to announce it to the world without first knowing if they would even grant him that release. But Scotty Too Hotty has made his intentions clear. He wants out of NXT. Johnny Gargano may want out of NXT soon as well. If he does, it'll take just a little while longer. We now know the latest on Gargano's status. He was announced as part of the War Games match, which is coming up next Sunday. His first War Games match. All those times that Undisputed Era was part of War Games, it's hard to believe that Gargano was not part of any of them. That's about to change, despite the fact that his contract is up 2 days earlier. According to Fightful.com, Gargano agreed to a 1 week extension of his contract to allow for him to participate in the War Games match. You know, this is playing out exactly the way that the Adam Cole situation did. Signing an extension to stick around and do business the right way on the way out. This does not sound like somebody who is fully on board to stick around if he is signing a 1 week extension to his current deal instead of signing a new one. Meltzer says he is still in talks with WWE about a potential new deal. I mean, so is Adam Cole. But he wants to also entertain any outside offers. And he would be foolish not to. Even if he does stay, and he may stay, he may well stay in WWE. Even if he does, it makes sense to see what the market is willing to offer. Try to get a better deal out of it. His wife's contract is set to expire in May. The belief is that the company will likely tack on all the time that she has missed since she was taken off TV due to being pregnant. And if they do that, then that would extend Candice LeRae's deal well into the latter part of next year. Yeah, it's like what they did with Rey Mysterio years ago when he missed all that time due to injury. They did the same thing to him. Although I think eventually he and WWE were able to work out a release, or their lawyers were. But between this and Kyle O'Reilly's deal coming up, NXT may be about to lose two of the last real remnants of its glory days under Triple H. Ciampa really is it after this, since we still don't know what Samoa Joe's health status is. I thought NXT this week was a more digestible episode, one of their better efforts since the 2.0 relaunch. We got more clarity on both War Games matches. They are doing the new school against the old school, which I had talked about last week was probably going to be the case. So they put him in the ring with Tommaso Ciampa, that being Grayson Waller, who is going to be one of the members of the new school in the War Games match. They put him in the ring with Tommaso Ciampa. Even in defeat, you know, he had a strong effort. They had a competitive match. Waller looked good. He's doing the old NXT Baron Corbin gimmick of shitting on the indies. That's his new gimmick now. I really liked the Cameron Grimes promo. That was as serious a promo from him as we have ever seen him give. He came out with his hair cut short after the poker showdown the week before with Duke Hudson. It's about shoulder length now, like Bailey. He talked about how tough times were coming up, growing up, and how no matter how much he may have struck it rich in wrestling or on Wall Street when he won all that money, he kept the long hair and the beard to remind him of his humble beginnings and the time that he had nothing. And Duke Hudson took that away from him. He made him angry. He wanted Duke to come out to the ring, but instead he popped up on the big screen. He was in the middle of getting a haircut of his own. He was at a barbershop. Well, not really, but I mean, I guess he was supposed to be in a barbershop. Unless they were just cutting his hair in the back. But he said Grimes' new look made him look a little bit less like a troll that lives under a bridge. And Grimes challenged him to go all in and have a hair versus hair match at War Games, which Hudson accepted. And then he showed off a Ziploc bag with chunks of Grimes' hair in it that he cut off last week. The goofy poker stuff aside, Grimes did a good job of establishing a reason for being upset that Duke gave him a haircut and what his hair meant to him before raising the stakes for their match at the War Games pay-per-view. Now the question is, do they go all the way with the makeover for Cameron Grimes and have him lose and shave his head? Or does Duke Hudson get his comeuppance? Because if the idea is to use the already established NXT stars to help get over the newer faces, then there's a very good chance Duke Hudson goes over in that match. I think that would be a mistake. I think Cameron Grimes should win. Tiffany Stratton is coming to NXT. We got a vignette for the newest addition to the NXT women's division, playing a spoiled rich girl character. She said, "Whoever said money can't buy happiness must have been poor. Daddy has paid for her tennis lessons since she was a little girl," she said. "Now Daddy says I'm ready to take over NXT." She is Jessica Wojnilko, 21 years old. She was part of their class of recruits in August, the same class that Solo Sikoa was part of. She's a bodybuilder. If you have not seen pictures of this woman body-wise, she looks like a blonde Jade Cargill, although I don't think it's tall. It was hard to tell from the video. It didn't come really across that way, since she was playing tennis in her tennis outfit. But that is who she is. With Indy Hartwell distracted, thinking about her husband's hand injury from last week when Carmelo Hayes and Trick Williams broke his hand, she and Persia Parada lost to Caden Carter and Casey Catanzaro, who who showed off some pretty good tandem offense. Indy kept staring at her ring finger, thinking about Dexter. This was comically over the top. I mean, the man had his hand stomped on, he wasn't shot. I get that he's an artist and he uses that hand to draw, but he's going to be fine, he'll live. Santos Escobar got a squash win over Malik Blade. Escobar is a star. He's a star without much to do right now. I would not dare suggest a Raw or a SmackDown move for him, even though that's exactly where he belongs, but I don't want him there because a release would likely follow. So you will not hear me advocating for a Santos Escobar promotion. So instead, I would like to see him doing more here in NXT. After the match, Kyle O'Reilly and Von Wagner came out, talking about wanting the NXT tag team titles, much the same way Legado del Fantasma does. And the champs, Imperium, showed up. Fabian Aichner suggested the other two teams wrestle each other for a chance to challenge them for the titles at War Games. Cora Jade picked up a distraction roll-up win over the NXT Women's Champion, Mandy Rose, when Kaylee Ray walked to the ring, casually swinging around a baseball bat. I would say that would distract me too. In the segment after this, backstage with the other members of the Women's War Games team congratulating Jade on her win, Kaylee Ray walked up and flat out said that she would be the fourth member of their team, as I predicted last week. So that completes the field for the ladies. It's going to be Dakota Kai and Toxic Attraction taking on Raquel Gonzalez, Io Shirai, Cora Jade, and Kaylee Ray. Kaylee Ray and Dakota Kai are going to have a ladder match this Tuesday, with the winner getting the War Games advantage for their team. We have another match official for War Games. Roderick Strong is going to defend his cruiserweight title against Joe Gacy. So there are officially no weight limits anymore for the cruiserweight title, because Gacy is every bit of 230. When Gacy's little Frankenstein monster showed up, Harland, he showed up. He was dressed like Michael Myers. And he was serenaded by chants of Michael Myers from the crowd at the PC, which, I've seen Michael Myers, and you, sir, are no Michael Myers. We know what Roddy can do between the ropes. Gacy is not a green guy, though. I mean, he's an experienced guy from the Indies, 3-time CZW World Champion, so they may end up having a pretty good match together. Carmelo Hayes retained his North American Championship in what was, as expected, a very good match against Johnny Gargano and Pete Dunne. Tony D'Angelo pulled Dunne out of the ring when he had Johnny dead to rights after a bitter end. Still keeping Dunne looking strong, I see. Hayes came off the top rope with the leg slice to Gargano to retain. The cheap interference was a way to explain Tony D'Angelo's involvement in the men's War Games match. There was a giant brawl to close out the show, mass chaos. They had the War Games siren blaring. Bron Breakker joined with the New School crew. Breakker, Hayes, D'Angelo, and Grayson Waller. They're going to be fighting Tommaso Ciampa, Johnny Gargano, Pete Dunne, and LA Knight. They're leaving it up to the fans to vote on WWE.com as to which members of each team should face off in the ladder match for the men on Tuesday to determine the man advantage. It's always a bit much having both ladder matches on the same show, but that is what we are getting on Tuesday. If the fan voting is legit, I don't see how it isn't Ciampa against Bron Breakker. But based on what happened in this main event, watch it be Pete Dunne and Tony D'Angelo. So I thought it was a more focused episode. Still very much a work in progress, though, is this NXT show. Let's dive into some of your questions here before we wrap up. You can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Michael, from Long Island. Who are your favorites for both the 2022 Men's Royal Rumble winner and Women's Royal Rumble winner? Well, Brock is coming back earlier than I expected, or else I would have gone with him for the men. For the Men's Rumble, I'm thinking Drew McIntyre, especially now that it looks like they may be running an angle where somebody in management has it in for the guy, you know, keeping him out of the Battle Royal on Friday. You know, Drew McIntyre went from the penthouse as the WWE champion to the outhouse real quick when his push fizzled out. If it's McIntyre and Roman Reigns or WrestleMania, then Drew wins the Men's Rumble. And on the women's side, if she can make it back in time. And ACL injuries are tricky because the recovery could be 6 months or it could be 9. Some people it could be longer if there's complications. But if she can make it back by the end of January, then Bayley would be my pick to win. And if she's not ready to return, I would go with Rhea Ripley. You know, she came close this year. It was down to her and Bianca Belair, and Bianca got the win. Rhea has not been much of a focal point on TV, doing the whole tag team thing with Nikki Cross chasing after a fucking egg on TV last week. It's time to get her back in the mix. And what's great about Rhea winning is that either champion works at WrestleMania. A match with Becky would be great. It's one we haven't seen before. And a match with Charlotte, you know, that's never really worked out real well in the past for Rhea Ripley. But if she finally wins, then that wraps that story up the right way. She takes the championship from Charlotte Flair. Now, I had also thought about Naomi. And I'm not really big on Naomi winning the Royal Rumble. I would rather go with Rhea. But the Naomi thing could work too. If the payoff to all of this Naomi stuff with her and Sonya Deville, and Sonya, you know, does not obviously want this woman to be wrestling for a championship anytime soon, then maybe the only way Naomi could get herself in the mix is to win the Royal Rumble. And maybe that's the payoff to this. Maybe the payoff to her being held down by Sonya Deville on TV is that she wins the women's Royal Rumble match. Maybe she even eliminates Sonya to do it. But, you know, Naomi winning the Rumble and challenging Charlotte at WrestleMania or Becky. The story is there, but to me, it's just not the marquee match I would do at WrestleMania. If anything, I'd rather see her get her revenge on Sonya one-on-one at WrestleMania. It doesn't even have to be for a championship. I think Rhea Ripley against Becky Lynch, or Rhea Ripley finally, you know, winning the title from Charlotte Flair, that to me could be the main event for night one of WrestleMania. If you want to headline WrestleMania night one with a women's match again like they did this year with Sasha and Bianca, and that was a great match, you could do that with Rhea Ripley against either of those women. I don't see the same marquee value in having Naomi in the women's main event of WrestleMania. I just don't see it. But story-wise, if they wanted to pay it off with a Naomi Rumble win, I could see that too. Faisal from Kuwait. I remember you mentioned during a recent mailbag that CM Punk should be the one to dethrone MJF, provided that MJF beats Hangman for the belt. So he's saying that Punk should be the one to dethrone MJF for the AEW Championship. But do you think Eddie Kingston should get the nod instead, especially after the reaction he got during his brief feud with Punk, as well as the widespread support he received for his Players Online article? That was the Players Tribune piece. He says, I feel there might be a stronger story with Eddie, a man who had to fight for everything he's got, beating the privileged rich kid from Plainview, Long Island, even if he only holds the title for a month. I don't see Eddie Kingston as the AEW champion. I think Eddie Kingston going for the TNT title and winning the TNT championship is much more likely. I just don't see the point in putting the title on Eddie Kingston just for the one moment and then, oh, you know, a month later you could take it off of him. I mean, you could. That's not really AEW's MO when it comes to crowning their world champions. So I see Kingston more at the TNT title level. I don't see him winning the AEW championship, and it's not something that I would do. Marcus from Dallas, my question is about the Money in the Bank match. It may be too early to think about WrestleMania, but given that every year WWE tries to get as many people onto the Mania card as possible, do you think they should move the Money in the Bank match back to WrestleMania like it was before they created a pay-per-view for it? Or do you prefer having a dedicated event for the match? No, I prefer having it at WrestleMania, but it's never going to happen. Money in the Bank has long overtaken Survivor Series as one of the big four shows of the year. Money in the Bank is in a stadium next year. They're going to try to put 50,000 people in a stadium in July, July 4th weekend, for a Money in the Bank pay-per-view. So Money in the Bank will never again go back to WrestleMania. Do I prefer it on the WrestleMania card? I do. It would be more challenging now, though. And this is one of the logistical reasons why it can't happen. You have one for the men. You have one for the women. Having two Money in the Bank matches on the WrestleMania card is a bit much. Now, they have two nights of WrestleMania. So that, if that becomes the norm every year going forward, if they just say, okay, we're just going to do two nights every year, you could have a Money in the Bank match on each night. That could work. That could be a draw. You want to sell tickets to the same stadium two nights in a row? You give the audience on both nights each a Money in the Bank match. One for the men, one for the women. That could work. So from a personal perspective, as a personal preference, yes, I would rather Money in the Bank go back to being an attraction at WrestleMania. I don't think it needs its own dedicated show, but the horse is out of the barn. And it is one of their bigger events of the year, so there's no reason for them to change from that formula. I'd rather them get rid of Hell in a Cell and TLC as standalone shows before they ever do anything to Money in the Bank. Sebastian from Bedford, UK, do you think a Stephanie McMahon-Becky Lynch feud could make for a compelling television story in 2022? And if so, how would you like to see it booked? I wouldn't. I don't find any McMahons on my television to be compelling anymore. We have had 25 years, off and on, of a McMahon power trip on TV, be it with Vince, with Shane, with Stephanie, Triple H, the honorary McMahon. So there was a compelling story to tell when Shane came back with him and Triple H, and they didn't do it. I don't need to see Stephanie feuding with anybody on television. And if she was going to give the rub to somebody by sharing TV time with them and slapping them around, it would, you know, doing it with somebody established like Becky doesn't make any sense. You would do it with somebody new who, in their mind, they would be trying to get over, but of course it would probably have the opposite effect and Stephanie would slap them around about 16,000 times. So no, I have no interest in seeing that. Dan from Niagara Falls, New York, who do you see having a brighter future, Sammy Guevara or Austin Theory? Austin Theory. I think both will go on to be big stars, but I think Austin Theory is going to go a lot higher than Sammy Guevara is. Joseph from Silsby, Texas, which superstar had the more promising future and could have been a key player in WWE if they did not have a career-ending injury, Tyson Kidd or Jason Jordan? Jason Jordan. Tyson Kidd was only going to get over at a certain level. He was never, ever going to be booked as any kind of top player in the company. I think he would have gone on to hold many more tag team titles. You know, him and Cesaro could have been a great tag team for a long time. He may have gone on to do other stuff in the tag team division. Maybe he would have had a run in the mid-card, you know, as a single star. Maybe. But that's as far as it would have gone for him. Jason Jordan was already being pushed at a top level before he got hurt. I think at the time he was a Raw Tag Team Champion with Seth Rollins. Seth was one of the biggest stars in the company at the time. He was young. He had the athletic background, great wrestler. Jason Jordan was going places if he didn't get hurt. Tyson Kidd wasn't going places the way Jason Jordan was. So Jason Jordan, by far, I think, would have been more of a key player in that company as far as on the card than Tyson Kidd. Tyson Kidd could have and is contributing in a big way behind the scenes. He works with the women a lot. Jason Jordan does too, by the way. He works behind the scenes now for them as an agent as well. But of the two, it was definitely Jordan with the higher ceiling. Jason from the Bronx, do you find yourself using any wrestler sayings or phrases in your everyday life? Whenever my friends try to get me to do something I don't want to do, I often say, "That doesn't work for me, brother," in the Hulkster voice. I do it too. "That don't work for me, brother," in the Hogan voice. I do that a lot, actually. I find myself saying the bottom line a lot. I don't know if I should blame Steve Austin for that or not, But I will sometimes say, and that's the bottom line, or that's the bottom line. I've also used Bobby Heenan's old saying whenever a friend annoys me and asks me for a favor. A friend in need is a pest. If they're not a wrestling fan, they probably would get very offended by that and not get the joke, but that's okay. And Alberto from Laredo, Texas. Can you tell us about your very first wrestling show you ever went to in person? I can. It was the day after Christmas, my father's birthday, in 1987, Madison Square Garden. I don't remember much about the show other than the main event. Main event was the Macho Man challenging the Honky Tonk Man for the Intercontinental title. So my first live main event was an Intercontinental Championship match. Jimmy Hart was suspended above the ring in a shark cage. I remember, you know, watching him screaming and crying as they lifted him slowly into the air. And I'm afraid of heights. You know, I'm obviously a young fan at that point. I'm watching this and I'm thinking, man, this guy's going to fall. He's going to get hurt. I was scared to death for him. I remember that. I remember the fear of watching him be lifted into the air. So that was my first live wrestling event. Way, way back. The year that Hogan slammed Andre. In 87. That was the first show I ever went to at MSG. If you have questions for the mailbag, keep emailing me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. I also replied earlier to a few people directly, so I try to do the best I can. I do read everything you send me. And you never know when I may use it here on the show. Follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. Subscribe on YouTube, Solomonster Sounds Off. You'll see the show logo, 66,000 plus and counting. That is the official channel. So sub on there. Make sure your notifications are in the on position. So when I post something new or I go live, you should get a notification about that. And all the information is on there about channel memberships. You'll see the little join button. Little white button under every single video. If you're not already a member, it'll say join. You can click it. It will not join you instantly. It will give you the information. A little video of me will pop up explaining some of the perks that you get for being a channel member. I thank all of our channel members, by the way. And I've got some fun stuff planned over these next couple of weeks there. Including, by the way, I've heard from a few people who do miss the phone calls. I know a lot of people don't, which is why I have scaled back on them. But I do think there's a place for them, and so what I think I'm going to do, we'll have probably like a pilot episode. I'll come up with a name for it. And what we'll do is we'll have like a call-in show exclusively for channel members. Won't be long, but maybe we'll do those from time to time, and we'll open up the phone lines to you guys exclusively for members, and we'll see how it goes. If it goes well, we'll make it a regular thing. And if not, then we won't. And we'll save the phone calls for those rare streams where I feel like doing them on the main streams. But I think it might end up becoming a members-only feature on the channel for the people who are interested in that. We'll keep it to a small group and see how that goes. So anyway, that is the show for this week. I want to thank you all for supporting me and supporting the show and tuning in, as I know many of you do each and every single week. 732 of these in the books. Episode 733 is next Sunday. That is NXT War Games Sunday. I don't know if I will be doing I'm not going to do a prediction stream, but I may or may not get a video up with predictions, but I will be live. I will be covering War Games as a pay-per-view, so when it goes off the air on Peacock next Sunday, I will be live streaming the review for War Games. I'll talk about that and remind everybody about that again next weekend. Actually, I'll probably just save my predictions for the podcast next Sunday. That's probably what I'll do. So I will see you for 7:33. I will see you on Wednesday night after Dynamite for the live Dynamite review. We have Dynamite and we have a live Rampage review on Friday, as we do each and every week. So I hope to see you there. Be well, stay safe, enjoy the rest of your November. And I will see you. We're almost done. 2021 is almost finished. We got one more month. Let's end it on a strong note. I'll see you next month. Take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Get a load of this tweet that I got. AEW is at the stage right now where they have earned the right to have nothing but positive comments. I really don't think you can make negative comments. Are you out of your fucking mind? Don't tell me what I can and cannot say. You really can't say anything negative. If I gave out an award each week for dumb tweet, I would frame this one and hang it up on my wall.
The Solo Monster sounds off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solo Monster on Twitter at Solo Monster.
Solo Monster.
Solo Monster.
Solo Monster sounds off.